Jesus is a guest at the home of a Pharisee, as we well know in this story today. And this isn't the only place in Luke's gospel where it happens. It happens two more times again in Luke chapter 11 and 14, where there is an appearance of Jesus at the home of a Pharisee. Now, if you do a little bit of a quick research, a quick overview of Luke's gospel from chapter 4 on in nearly every chapter, except for maybe one or two chapters, there is some reference to food or eating or a meal. And it seems that Jesus goes sort of from one dinner party to the next. And maybe it's no accident then that he's accused of doing a lot of eating and drinking by his critics. Some of the most significant of Jesus' stories happen at dinner tables. It makes sense, doesn't it, why Jesus was such a frequent guest at the table of others. As we know, he had no home of his own, no kitchen for which to make food. We might say that he was in some ways a beggar, totally dependent upon the hospitality of others. The consumption of food, at least in Luke's gospel, is a sign of Jesus' dependency upon the kindness of others, as well as his own vulnerability, and in a way becomes a model to his disciples and to us. Because you remember that when he sends them out, he says for them to take no provisions, no tunic, no bag, no food. Go and be served. Often at the table, Jesus speaks of the needs of others. And here in our story, the dinner had no sooner began when this penitent woman bursts in upon the scene and makes a big fuss over Jesus and seeks his forgiveness and is forgiven. Things happen quickly and surprisingly and disturbingly in this text, and the tables are quickly turned on the host, and the Pharisee, who we later has a name, Simon, thinks that he's the righteous person and this woman is the sinner, and without feeling he has very much need of forgiveness and feeling like she has all the need for forgiveness, the tables quickly turn when she is forgiven one and he stands in great need of forgiveness. But by the end of the meal, it seems like everyone there at the table is aware of having various kinds of needs. Well, I suppose that as you look at Luke's gospel, that one of the most famous meals in Luke's gospel is the grand party thrown to welcome home the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. That great shift in the story of the prodigal son happens when the son, off in the foreign land, turns to go back home. And he makes that move from the far country out of need, out of hunger. His horrible and hunger in that context is contrasted in his mind to the plenty that he had back home and to the thoughts of his father. And we might ask, how and why did he make that move back toward home? We might have grown up thinking he came to his senses, that he really repented, that he was somehow aware of this spiritual longing in his soul, when really I think he's just darn hungry. There's a famine. He realizes that the pigs are better off than he is. Good grief. And he, in Jesus' evocative words, comes to himself. like he's away from himself, but he comes to himself. And he realizes there's no food here, but there's food back home. And it was his hunger that propels him back to his father. Pretty basic. Jesus' good news is good news for the hungry. Of course, when Jesus speaks of hunger, he often speaks metaphorically, as if hunger means more than just simply an empty stomach, as if hunger were a simile for an empty life, not just an empty belly. And as Cheryl has already said, to be honest, we do some of our worst things out of hunger. Hunger is a powerful motivation that we know we act crazily when we are very hungry. And it goes all the way back to that classic Old Testament story of Esau selling his birthright for a little bit of porridge, soup, whatever it was. The cheat Jacob tricks his older brother. And Esau does this in a moment of physical hunger, of desperation. And it created havoc in the family system that worked its way down for generations. And when the Hebrew people were hungry, there in the desert, in their wilderness, they felt like they had been better off back in Egypt in slavery. It was crazy thinking, but when we're hungry, we react often rather than respond. And sometimes we try to assuage our hunger in the wrong ways. We hunger for bread, but what we're really hungry for is love or intimacy or belonging or friendship or community or for feeling like our short lives on earth here really matter some way. And there's hungry for power. Hunger for power. Stephen Colbert, who I tape sometimes because it comes on at 11 o'clock and I don't usually stay up that late, but then I watch it and fast forward through all the commercials and the next evening, has this little segment that he calls the Hungry for Power Games. And when all of the political candidates were in the race and one would drop out and he would do this big funny spiel on this hungry for power that has all kinds of expressions. We see the worst of seeking political power just for the experience of power. And very recently in the news, again, tragic story of rape on one of our college campuses. And as you know so well, rape is never about love or sex or intimacy. It's always about power over another. And sometimes I wonder if there just might be a connection between the problems of obesity in our culture and hunger. That sounds strange, I know, but we know that sometimes we attempt to fill the void of our lives with food when food really isn't the solution. It's not the real longing. There's a deeper need there. Now, some of the best things that we do out of hunger. Jesus said in his classic Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are those who are hungry, for you will be filled." Why blessed? I don't know. Maybe it's that when we are hungry, it seems that some other things sort of come into perspective. Our life focuses, and all the things we thought we needed sort of fall away, and we know that what we really need is nourishment. Our very lives are at stake, and we would be willing to risk about anything for food. You might remember in the play or the movie Les Miserables, the main character breaks into a shop and steals a loaf of bread in order to feed his family. He's not a criminal by nature, not by any stretch of the imagination, but his family is hungry. And I cannot imagine what it would be like to have children hungry and not be able to do anything about it. He will risk anything to feed them. And he spends the rest of his life paying for that crime of breaking in and stealing that loaf of bread, but he never feels sorry for what he'd done, nor did he ever apologize for his crime, because he did it out of love to feed the hungry. My friend Jimmy, a recovering alcoholic, has been hungry for some 20 years now. Sober, but hungry. Hungry to walk with others who are experiencing addiction. And so Jimmy faithfully, almost daily, attends AA meetings. Not only to deal with his own hunger, his own need, but because he wants to walk alongside others and make his life count for others. Harold and Roberta, I believe that your hunger for justice for LGBTQ people grows out, I believe, of the death of your brother, Ray. Isn't that right, Roberta? A hunger that drives a person like Cheryl East to become a nurse grows out of that compassion to see people's lives be restored. And I could say the same for all of you, I think, that hunger somehow motivated you to teach, to lead, to build a business, to serve needs, to care for children, to serve the church. And I'm told that when we feel hungry, it's as though literally every cell of our body is screaming the same message. Feed me, I'm hungry. And grandchildren are just more real about that and more present to it than perhaps the rest of us. And the psalmist says that as a deer pants for water, so his soul yearns and longs and hungers for the living God. There's so much talk in the Bible about food and banquets and parties and bread and famine and hunger that I think living in a culture where we've never experienced famine, we're at somehow a definite disadvantage. It's as if these scriptures go right over our head, or we sort of lose them somehow, or lose a sense of urgency and power that they have. We think that God is somehow about making us maybe our lives a little better, but so much of the Bible is about people who are genuinely hungry, who do not have enough food, for whom God is their last hope, and the only thing between them and death is compassionate people, God's people, motivated by their love for God. Mennonite World Review this week had an article about MCC assisting Syrian refugees with food. 4.6 million Syrians have fled their country. And MCC is working with churches and government and the government of Canada to make available vouchers for nearly 6,000 people. $60 a week per, or $60, $80 per month per family, provided supplemental food for people to give them hope and to keep hunger from their doors. And these were people that were much like you and I before having to flee for their lives and suddenly find themselves with nothing, not even food. We don't face physical hungers. Maybe some of you now are smelling some smells from the kitchen and feel a little bit of something going on down there that signals some perhaps physical hunger. But we do well to be in touch with what hungers we bring today and any day. And they change by the day and maybe by the minute. But tragically, I think the church has taught us that we're to pretend that we're never hungry. Or that we always hunger for the right things. We've learned to put on these smiley faces, to dress up, to hide those shameful hungers. But as author Glennon Doyle Melton says so well, when she says, the rule, perhaps the only rule of the church, is this thing called grace. Grace, where there is no shame. There is nothing that you can do and have done that puts you outside the love of God and the embrace of the community of God's people. You can be forgiven, Glennon says. And Glennon knows, because she is in recovery and found faith and discovered life and hope, and now shares her public speaking, blogging, and has created a movement called Momastery. Momastery.com. Check it out. Where she just providing hope, especially for women all around the world, by her honesty and vulnerability. And by the way, Glennon will be the speaker at this fall's Penn Foundation's autumn event in late September. Tickets are on sale. But my ongoing prayer is that when anyone walks through our doors, they might find this community to be a place where they can be real and we can be real. This past week, sat with new friends Glenn and Mary Miller at St. Andrew's with the veteran circle called Compass. Glenn was reflecting on an address, and I meant to send it out to you, and I still will, address that he gave on Memorial Day in Lansdale. For some of you who don't know Glenn Miller, Glenn's a Vietnam veteran who suffered for years now with post-traumatic stress disorder. Managed to find a way to sort of set that aside, all the night terrors and agony, to have a successful career, and now in retirement to especially have a passion and hunger for addressing the needs of veterans in our community. And Glenn would have our culture get real. His word, get real. To be honest about the realities of war and what war does to people who are in combat and even those who are not in combat. How it makes us all less human. That honesty is what attracts me, I think, in many ways. The Glenn also makes me a little scared of him. But that honesty to believe that our life journey matters, that when we go off the tracks, there will be people there that will support us. And when our lives are on tracks and we're feeling pretty good about who we are and where we are, we'll celebrate with us. For in today's gospel, Jesus is with a man who believes himself to be pretty much all together. He's righteous, he knows it, and knows others aren't, including this woman who's making such a fool of herself, slobbering all over his distinguished guest. And he's aghast. How can this be? This embarrassing emotionalism, this thinly veiled eroticism. Why, any moment, I'm sure Simon expects Jesus to brush her off and have his bouncers throw her out of the room. That's not at all what happens. As I said, the tables are turned, and Jesus commends this woman's grateful, honest posture and criticizes this aloof self-righteousness. Do we get it? Both the righteous-sounding Simon and this nameless woman are hungry. They have needs. We might say that they are both saint and sinner. And they are hungry in such different ways. Both, though, need a God who loves and forgives them. They need a community to stand with them. And the woman knows she needs a forgiving God and a healing community. And she's hungry for intimacy. And the Pharisee, who presumed righteous, is not in touch with his hunger. And he doesn't appear to need anyone. Now, in his first sermon, Jesus says he's come to preach good news to the hungry. Back in Luke chapter 4. And so this morning, I invite us to eat together in a few minutes, to bring our hungers to this place, to come as we are here, knowing that we can do so without shame, knowing that we are forgiven people, knowing that we are loved and blessed. But please, let's not be like that Simon Pharisee who cannot own his need and who denies all hunger. And please know for sure that I'm speaking and preaching to myself, because pastors can get put up on pedestals of goodness and easily slip into self-righteous thinking. It's a dangerous place to be. And we need confessors. We need places where we can be totally honest with our hungers for intimacy and how that works itself out in our relationships with male and females. We need places where we can be honest about our need for recognition, about our jealousies of other pastors. We need honesty where we can be honest about our hunger for power, to just name a couple of the besetting temptations for pastoral leaders. I don't know what hungers you bring this morning, but we'll be silent together this morning, maybe a little bit longer than usual, for us to grapple a little bit here together. Maybe aware of a little bit of hunger in your own stomach, that's good. But also aware of the hunger in your soul, which is also good. It's a sign. It's drawing you. It's drawing you here this morning. And as the bulletin says, in silence, allow the Spirit to reveal your hungers. Try to be honest with the ways you try to meet these longings in ways that do not satisfy. And at the same time, can you also name those hungers that are life-giving and that serve others? Honest about both. Let this time not only be one of confession of false hungers, but one of gratitude for God's forgiveness and for the ways God plants hungers among us, that our lives might be fruitful and Spirit-filled, hungers for justice, for mercy, for compassion, for healing, for peace, and for thriving communities. So I invite us now into a time of silence. Allow the Spirit to speak to your heart through your hunger. Be willing to name that hunger, both how we sometimes label things positive and negative. Just let it be and let it come, whatever it might be that comes in the silence. And then we will break our silence with serving you bread from the bakery of our sister baker, Cheryl East. Thank you, Cheryl. Let's enter the silence.